It's up front and it's candid. This is Unrestricted. Levi, I have to say that I'm going to start off this segment and this conversation by saying that you and I don't know each other that well, although I follow you on social media. And I have to say, and I was saying this to our good friend Chris Hockey before you came in here, and I said, Chris, of all the guys that I follow on social media, you will not find a more positive, energetic, happy person to follow than you. And, you know, we've had now a few minutes to just sit and rip and talk and whatever before I hit record. But, dude, you are – I don't know how you do it. I know that you're sponsored by Red Bull, but there's no way that you can drink Red Bull, you know, 24 hours a day. But honestly, dude, you are always happy. You are. You're always smiling. I don't know if you know that about yourself, but I love your follow because you seriously are happy doing what you do.
I mean, that's the truth. I'm happy to be here having the opportunity to do these things, you know, and I think that's the thing that's always been the thing that I go back to is, you know, when I was younger, I had a job working at the grocery store when I was 12. I was determined to, you know, it was so I could buy my snowmobile is what it was for, right? And after I became a professional snowmobiler and I was living this dream of being a pro and being able to go all over, it really made me stop and say, appreciate this because, you know, you have this is what you dreamt of and you're living that right now. So I appreciate that. And as I got into it and, you know, we started having success, it really made me look at even the smaller details because I almost felt like I don't deserve this. This is so awesome. I don't know if anyone could deserve this, right? So that's why I've always just thought like, man, be appreciative of what you have, what you're able to do. And then if you start digging into things a little bit further, it's like I think another thing that's really fun about the whole thing is being able to meet people like yourself and talking because, you know, a quote that I heard was everyone you meet knows something that you don't, right?
That's a great quote.
Which is very true. Yeah. You wouldn't know everything that they know.
Right.
But with that said, you should be able to learn something from everyone you meet then. Right. So if we look at it that way, which I don't do this all the time, which I wish I would, but it's nice to think of that, say, man, everyone you meet, regardless of what it is, whether you like it or don't like it, you can learn from them. And I think Jim Rohn was the one that said it best. He said, you know, you can learn from somebody that's a millionaire or you can learn from somebody that's struggling, that's on the streets. Right? You can learn what to do and what not to do.
Right.
Right? So it's like he said, it would be great to see somebody that, or not great, but it'd be an interesting conversation to have with somebody that had lost it all and ask him, how did you do that? Right? Just to find out. And so that's kind of my thing is I always try to look at like the situation and go, you know, it could be worse and what can I learn?
Yeah. Well, that's a great thing to take away. But the thing is on top of that, you can live that way. You can tell yourself to do that and maybe be inspired by quotes like that. But it's another thing to actually open your ears and your mind to do that, you know, because I think we've all been in situations where you're meeting somebody for the first time and maybe you're distracted or maybe something happened through the course of the day and you're not as open to what that person is saying. And maybe you're just flooded with your own thoughts. But to have that sort of that daily reminder of like, if you're going in a new situation or going into to meet a new person that, hey, this is a learning opportunity.
Right.
You know, this is a chance for me either to see what this douchebag is doing wrong and be like, okay, don't be like that guy.
Yeah.
Or walk into somebody's office or meet somebody that's super cool and doing it the right way. And like, damn, man, I need to do what that guy's doing.
Exactly.
And I need to learn from him or her on what they're doing. So anyway, and I think just a testament to what I was laying out earlier about just your energy is, dude, you drove 3.5 hours to do this, you know, and it's sort of my fault that I wasn't clear when we were texting, like, you know, I was doing this podcast and you're like, great, you know, what time do you want to do the Zoom or whatever? I'm like, oh shit, like I didn't tell you that, like I like to do these things in person. Yeah. And you, without a beat, you're like, cool, let me just push it a day and let's meet in person. And,
yeah.
and then you know, you drove all the way down here, and God, I hope you're doing something else in the cities other than sitting down and talking to my podcast. But so I know, thank you for doing that, and I really appreciate it. You know, going back into your childhood, mm-hmm. it sounds like you've always had this ember and this spark to be a professional racer. Was it always a professional racer on a snowmobile? Or did the snowmobile sort of just come about organically in a different way, and you're like, ah, this is what I'm gravitating towards?
Yeah, I think when I was a kid, you know, growing up, I was always into power sports and stuff. I wasn't even quite four, and my dad got me a little four wheeler, right? And it wasn't long, like within the year, he had propped a hood up, like he propped a hood off an old car up on wood blocks, and that was like my first jump. And I would be jumping this, and my dad thought it was the funniest thing. He'd be like, ah, get over here, check this out, Levi, hit the jump, you know, and I'd hit the jump. And so I was really into that stuff early on. And then snowmobiling came about when I was, you know, 7, 8 years old. My parents got back into snowmobiling. And, you know, I used to sit in front of my dad, and he would drive, and then he would let me drive with him on the back. And then the next year, he got me a used Indy 400. I remember the sled. And he
posted about that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I just got the same exact year one. It's not the same one,
not the same
but
one
the
too.
Same model and everything. I just bought it because I'm like that is where it all started. My passion for snowmobiling and you know that was the thing that I loved. But what I really enjoyed in kind of talking, you know, when you were talking to Ryan Dungy about, you know, how he kind of living in Minnesota hindered his dirt biking because there's other guys that are riding all the time. And he said he thought that maybe that helped just because he didn't get burnt out because he was switched over. And for me, you know, especially nowadays, I see this with a lot of youth athletes and youth kids they're so deep into the sport, one particular sport, that they just eat, sleep, and breathe it. And I just remember as a kid, I'd follow the season. This time of the year, it's football season. Then I'd switch to basketball season. Then I'd go to baseball. And then in the summer, I would ride four-wheelers or whatever else. And in the meantime, I would ride my snowmobile and kind of fill that in. And I did that. I played all three sports up through ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved playing just regular sports. And then in ninth grade, I remember I went out for basketball, and I was – you know, I would have been the point guard is what I would have been. We live in a real small school. And so I was going to be the point guard. And I like started the first week, and all I kept thinking about was snowmobiling. And I just,
really?
I would go home and I'd go ride. And yeah. I told him, I'm like, I'm not into this. My heart's not into this. I'm like, I'm not going to be able to do this. So I stopped playing basketball that year. I played all of baseball, but I had the same struggle with dirt bikes. I was like, I wanted to ride my dirt bike nonstop, and so I stopped playing baseball after that ninth grade year, and then it actually worked out good because I always really enjoyed playing football, and by the end of summer, I was like pretty much burnt out on dirt biking, so I'd have my little football window for a couple months, and then if it's snowing, I'd go into snowmobiling. So I had this like, it worked out like so perfect for, you know, for the rest of high school, where I got to play football, and I'd switch over to snowmobile and then to dirt bikes. And that, you know, that where it kind of hit me was like probably when I was at 14, 15, ninth grade, just a little bit after that. That's when it really hit me that I like snowmobiling is my passion and I love this. And that's when we really started racing a lot. And we had success early when I was like in the junior classes, mm-hmm. just based on in the younger races back then, if you could jump, if you were willing to go big, you could usually win the race. And that's what I would do. I wasn't scared to jump. And then as time went on, you know, you make up, they say jump for show, corner for dough.
Yeah.
And that's very real. Like the faster you become in the corners, because everyone figures out how to jump eventually.
Right.
then you got to figure out how to link that. And that's what took me a little bit, because I've always been good at committing for the jump and taking the risk, but the cornering and like actually thinking it through and using my head.
The strategy behind it.
That's where it took me a little bit to figure out.
That's so funny, because they use that same analogy in golf. It's like you can drive for show but putt for dough, because it is about the little things. It's about the little things that kind of give you that edge. When you're grown up, because I didn't grow up knowing anything about motorsports, really, specifically snowmobile. I didn't even know that was really a competitive thing, really, until the X Games came around.
Right.
When you were coming up, even at the junior ranks and the really amateur ranks with the young kids, was that industry built out? Like, could you look at yourself and say, "Oh, there actually is a professional circuit that I could be on," or did that kind of grow with you?
To be honest, it kind of. I mean, there was like a professional series and stuff, but it was never like that's going to be my job period.
I guess, was an actual industry and a career that you could say, man, I'm just going to give up basketball and baseball, and I'm really going to do this,
right?
Maybe not just motorsports, but specifically snowcross or snowmobiling, because there it is. It's already out
right.
there.
You know that it's there.
Yeah,
I could be that guy. And yeah, it wasn't. It was just on the beginning of that, like when I was in those early years, and that was like, I would say the guys that really made it, like, I'm a professional snowmobiler, where the like Blair Morgans and even Tucker Hibbert, I think even a year or two younger than me at that time, but he was so early to it. But those guys really made it where you're like, whoa, I could be just a professional snowmobiler. And it's like many professional careers. It's like, that's your window, you know, like Ryan had mentioned, it's like you have this 10-year or whatever window of time when you're going to do that, and then you move on to the next steps. And, I looked at it as, when I started riding, I started in the junior classes and we had success, and then I struggled for a little bit until I started figuring things out. And then that was just as people were like starting to make careers of racing. And that's kind of when I like came in. So timing wise, it worked out really well, because, I kind of came in right when that X Games time started. I actually was a little bit behind the ball. They did the first snowcross at X Games in 98. And then my first X Games was 5 years later.
Yeah.
So it had been kind of established a little bit more by then. But I fell right into that. And the freestyle and all of the other things that we ended up doing later on was completely unheard of when we started. And that's what was kind of funny about my career is I'd always, even when I was a kid, I wanted to throw a trick, because I remember watching dirt bikes, and I used to really like Jeremy McGrath, who won all the Supercross races, the most ever, and he would always throw a trick at the finish line. And I would just sit there and wait. I would just wait. When he was out in the lead, I'm like, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. And he'd throw a knack-knack off the triple. And I remember being in the stands when I was like, I don't remember how old I was. I was sitting there. It would have been 97. I remember he was on a Suzuki. It was his first win of that season, and we were right next to that triple, and he throws this huge knack-knack, and I was just like, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it right now. It was just so cool, and I was just like, that's like all I wanted to do. And when I went racing, like, I was the kid that was like, I would do a trick off the finish line if I got third. Like, it didn't matter. I just wanted to do it. So
if you're going to race for that long, I don't care where you're going to finish, just hit that jump and hit hard. I'm going to get my money's worth.
Yeah, so I'd always kind of go that way. And then it's like in racing, it's like not cool to be that guy, right? You don't want to be the guy like way to go, you got third. So, but I was just like, wanted to entertain, I think. And when freestyle came about, that's all it is you're literally entertaining. You're putting on as good the best show you can for not only the people, the spectators, but for the judges.
Yeah.
And they're going to go, oh yeah, that was awesome. And then you're going to score higher. So like when I fell into or kind of stumbled into freestyle via speed and style, this other discipline at X Games, I went, holy cow, this is what I'm supposed to do. Like, I think I've been a racer and I figured out how to become functional at racing, but the freestyle came so easy to me because it was kind of what I always like was doing before that.
Right. Right. Yeah, because you had to learn racing secondarily because you just love to hit the jumps and go big.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
When you talk about your first little thing when you were like 4 or 5 years old and your dad's making little jumps and stuff for you, do you ever remember being scared? Like, was it one of those things like you truly are just kind of born with this gene where you were more excited than you were nervous to take jumps?
I would say that's probably the biggest misconception about, I mean, at least myself, you know, because a lot of people see me and they go, holy cow, you jumped 400 and some feet. You did
a world
double
record. It's still standing, right?
Correct. And you did a double backflip and stuff. And it's like, yeah, I did. But there's fear on top of fear. And the thing is even like as a little kid and stuff, it's just like anything. Like you see a jump, you're going to jump off something or whatever. You're going to jump off into the lake or you're going to jump off something like that. And you get that feeling. You get those same feelings. But the difference is as you have more experience and as you learn more, you realize that it's how you control that fear. And you go, you start doing like this risk analogy of what, have I prepared for this? Am I capable of this? Is the machine or whatever I'm doing?
You trust it.
Can I do that? Yeah. And do I have the ability to do this? And you know, as time went on, you know, there are definitely the earlier years where you just said, just going to send it, you know, and you hang on and you hope for the best. And as time goes on, you go, you know, there's a lot of hospital trips with that approach. So
you've had a lot of injuries, dude.
So we got to figure out a better way to go through this.
Do you consider yourself a daredevil?
See, that's what the funny thing. I don't at all. I don't. Yeah, I don't.
It doesn't sound like
it
because it sounds like you're like, I'm genuinely excited to do these things as long as I can go through this mental calculation if this makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas maybe some professional daredevils or even amateur daredevils, they just throw caution to the wind and say like, that's going to get a rise out of people, that's going to entertain people, and I'm just going to go.
Right.
And then they end up getting hurt.
Right. And don't get me wrong, there was a lot of early years of that, you know, and then it kind of like to, I think what happened was like early on, you know, I've always been pretty ambitious about some of my goals and trying to be creative with what can we do? Like it was always the question, what can I do on my snowmobile? And I think that's what I found as I look back and reflect on it is it's more of the problem solving. It's like, here's what, you know, the vision is in my head is like, I want to try that. Or wouldn't it be cool if we did this?
Right.
And then it's going back and saying, well, how can you do that?
You're working backwards.
Yeah. How can you build a practice setup that's safe so you can do that? If it's never been done, or what does it take? And that's where, you know, as far as the daredevil aspect of it, you know, most people think of it as like you're that guy that goes and signs up for it and does it, right?
Right.
It's like, well, you do, but you go through all these practice and you're the one that's trying to figure out how to do it in a safe manner so you can achieve it.
So before we hit record, you were telling me the story about you doing a backflip.
Yeah.
With your team and your team owner at Polaris. And if you could just sort of like run through that story again, because it's interesting when you talk about working backwards from a goal. Like, first of all, what made you say like, oh, I'm going to do a backflip? Like, yeah, I can take this 500-pound machine and flip it around upside down and land it safely. Like, so what was the genesis behind it? And then tell everybody the conversation that you had with your boss.
So where the backflip kind of, it started as I was a racer and I was a professional racer and I was winning races. I was successful in racing. And it's funny because, you know, I've done a lot of reflecting over the years to kind of like understand why this stuff happens. And, you know, I raced and I was healthy there for a couple seasons. And it was funny because as I look back at that, it was like the longer I stayed healthy, the crazier the stuff would become because I would kept getting more confident. Mm-hmm. And I would build my confidence up big and then I would go for it. And so what happened was 2006, you know, we won some races in racing. The next year I did a little bit better in racing. And then that following year, I was like geared up, ready to take on the world in racing. And X Games approached me and said, hey, we're going to have this new event called Speed and Style, which is a combination of snowmobile racing and snowmobile freestyle, of the tricks and backflips and stuff like that. And, you know, you've always been one of the racers that have, you know, thrown some tricks off the mm-hmm. finish line. You know, if you can prove to us that you can do like freestyle worthy tricks, you can be entered in this new discipline. And I went, whoa. You know, and they tell me this, it's like September, right? So our season, we're practicing snowcross in November. So it's like, I have very little time. So I'm like, awesome. Yeah. Let me see if I can make it happen. So right away I called Red Bull because I had absolutely no idea even where to get a ramp to jump freestyle. And I'm like, do you guys know where I can get a ramp? Like, can somebody build it or how do I go about this? And they're like, we'll send one out. So they had one built and sent to me. In the meantime, I went out and I started building the landing, and this is all like while I'm doing my training, getting ready for snowmobile race season. And so I'm training, and I have a wood chip set up with like you'd have to skip across the pond to keep the snowmobile cool. So you'd skip the pond, line up for the ramp, hit the jump.
You're saying
back.
The treads. You're saying to keep the treads cool? Is that
yeah,
what you're saying?
Okay. Yeah.
Just so I'm following you.
Yeah, so the
you're
high...
Not on, yeah, not on snow.
Right,
on
and that's like one of the biggest cooling things with snowmobiles is this track actually kicks the snow up into the tunnel, which is like that aluminum piece that you're essentially sitting on. There's heat exchangers in there, which that's where the snow gets thrown on there and it helps cool the machine. So when you eliminate snow, you eliminate the cooling. So they only go like... a couple minutes and they start to overheat.
Wow.
So we dug a pond and I filled it with a garden hose and I would water skip across that to cool it down. And I hit this jump and I just session, you know, as long as I could to try to learn tricks. And then in that process, so I did that for like a few weeks and then I went into snowcross racing mode. So I was just practicing there. I went to the first race and you know we had some success there. I think we got a couple podiums, like second or third or something, which that was where it was kind of tough is I was like the top placing Polaris, right? So that next week I go into backflip mode. I'm like I'm going to land my first backflip or I'm going to try it. So I planned on doing it on Sunday. I had everything set up. My buddy was his dad was a paramedic, so he was going to come out.
Yeah, you know? Need that.
Because I checked the box on everything. Yeah. Well, in case it goes wrong. So I had him and lined up, and then on Friday, I get a call from the Polaris race director, you know, who he's like the racer's boss, right? Yeah. He's the one that hires you. And he calls me, he leaves me a voicemail, and it's like, Levi, this is Tom. I heard a dirty rumor. You better call me back. And I went, oh man, in my head I just went busted. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. So I call him back and he's like, I heard that you're planning on doing a backflip. And I said, but hear me out, Tom. I think I can do it. And he's like, absolutely not. And because they look at it, because, you know, I was hired as a racer. I'm supposed to be a top level racer, and they don't want to take any unnecessary risks.
Yeah.
Right?
Because
yeah. They're invested in you. So I'm like, here I am. I'm trying to do a backflip, which at that time, there were very few guys that were doing it, like less than, you know, probably five, six people in the world that did backflips on snowmobiles. So I'm like, no, I really feel good about this. And he's like, do you know how much trouble you, me, and Tim Bender, your race director or your crew chief would get in if you got hurt? And, you know, this is me as a, let me think what I would have been, like early 20s, you know? And I'm like, no, I really feel good about this. And he said, if you have any doubt whatsoever, just don't do it. And I'm like thinking in my head, I'm like, I'm going to backflip this 500-pound machine, which I haven't done, and I'm extremely nervous. So I have all kinds of doubt.
Yeah.
And I tell him, I'm like, no, I feel really good about this, right? And then Sunday finally arrived, and we had like just a disaster of a day trying to get the setup all done, you know, get the ramp and the landing and everything ready for it. And it's literally, it's becoming darker. It's like dusk where we're like running out of light to even try it. And I remember my buddy was pushing snow up the landing with a skid steer, and he couldn't get the skid steer to push the snow up there. That was one of our biggest hurdles. And he finally made it. And there was like five of us, and we all were like, yes, like yeah. It's happening. And he got the landing, and then I went and I got the sled warmed up, and I remember I hit the ramp. I hit the ramp seven times, did seven setup jumps, and on the eighth jump, I went for it. And
so let me stop you there. How fast is your machine going to hit this jump?
Oh, so that's like the funny thing with backflips is
you're not going that fast?
You're creeping into it, because once you get to the ramp, you just hold the throttle wide open. So, and the snow was accelerate so hard. So, you know, I'll get to another story of that. So you get to the ramp, you hold it wide open. So the sled deck kind of slams into the ramp, and it helps it kind of wheelie off of the ramp to do the flip. So I told you I did seven setup jumps, and then I finally did on the eighth jump. And fortunately, we were successful with that eighth jump. So we went back out the next day, and I started hitting the ramp, and I'm like, it just doesn't seem like I have enough time anymore, like to just do regular jumps. Well, what I had done is the night before flip day, I went out and I smoothed out the ground. I smoothed out all the snow with the skid steer, so it was perfectly flat. Right? And to make sure the ramp was nice and sturdy, I set the steel ramp on this perfectly flat snow. Well, what I essentially did was I made a sheet of ice, and then I set this metal ramp on it.
Oh.
So as I'm hitting this ramp in those seven times, the ramp had moved like 9 feet forward.
Whoa.
So I'm like, each time I hit the ramp, it's getting shorter and shorter and closer, giving me less and less time in the air. So when I do the flip finally, it was like, you know, I lost, you know, 9 feet of actual distance. So fortunately I made that, and we learned, you know, like many things, you learn the hard way.
Lesson, yeah.
So I learned that.
You didn't break your back doing that.
Yeah.
The hard way.
Yeah. So that was interesting. So anyway, we made it. I called Tom, the race director, said it was a success. And so we did the one backflip on that Sunday. I did three the next day on Monday, five on Tuesday, and then we packed it up. And I said, man, I think I can qualify for not only speed and style, but for freestyle as well. So we went out to Montana and competed in the freestyle qualifier for X Games, and we're fortunate enough to win that and eventually go on to X Games.
So when you're getting ready to do the backflip, knowing that only a small handful of people around the world have ever done it, did you reach out to people? Did you have people that had done it, other racers that had done it? Was there film watching, like in our sport in football, we're always kind of watching film to see how you can get better and what the other team is doing. Now, in a sense like this, are you doing that? Like, you're watching other film, like, okay, this is how they're doing, this is how they're throttling, this is what they're pulling on, like body position, all that stuff.
You definitely, I mean, there's no like, there, especially back then, there was no like real technique to it. You kind of like, you would look at the video of the few guys that were doing it and go, he's really struggling to get it around. This guy's doing it the best. Let's mimic his program. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing like really telling you, but I was fortunate enough to meet Justin Hoyer, who is not too far from the cities here. And he was one of the first, if not the first guys that had a foam pit for snowmobiles.
Yeah.
And I talked to him right away when they asked if I could do speed and style. And I said, is there any way I could like come out there and try to learn how to flip? And it was funny because he said, yeah, you can, because you're not going to be one of my competitors, because I was only going to be in speed and style.
Right.
So I go out and I do these flips into the foam pit, and this was like right away when I first started hitting ramps, so I knew very little. And I learned how to do a seat grab, which is one of the like standard freestyle tricks. I learned that at Justin's house, and so he was just like, yeah, you're not going to be one of my competitors, no big deal. Well, then the freestyle stuff, I mean, I was picking off these tricks, I was learning them so quick, I'm like, I have a full freestyle run. So then I ended up, you know, trying to qualify for it. I ended up winning the qualifier, and then later we went on to X Games that year, and we won speed and style and freestyle. And I'm like, sorry, man.
Yeah, sorry. Like, thank you for letting me use your pit.
Yeah.
Sorry that I just beat everybody, including yourself.
I mean, because he expressed it early on that I wasn't going to be a competitor, and I didn't have any intentions.
Yeah.
Of doing freestyle. It was just all of a sudden I'm like, you know, because I watched the video and I wrote down what the defending gold medalist, Chris Brandt, he won the first X Games in freestyle. And I went, all right, just, you know, figure out his tricks. If you can do that, maybe you'll be able to qualify. And so I learned those tricks and they came really, really easy. Not easy, but they come quick for me. And so I'm like, holy cow. So then I went there and one of the things that first year was my racing background paid off, because it's a 75-second run, and I was able to get in like three more jumps than everyone.
Oh, right.
So that's why I was able, you know, to win that first year, was just because I did a lot more jumps.
Well, I hate to interrupt such a great conversation, but I have to thank my sponsors. I couldn't do this without my sponsors, so I want to thank Douglas and Todd Small Batch Bourbon. Everything about Douglas and Todd is all Minnesota. The wheat, the corn is all grown within 30 miles of the distillery up in Osakis. It is distilled there. It's bottled in Princeton, Minnesota, and distributed around the country. It is bourbon season, people. The weather's getting cold, and I can't think of a better thing on a cool night. Nice little glass of bourbon. So Douglas and Todd Small Batch Bourbon, please enjoy responsibly. 21 plus bourbon whiskey. It is 46.5% alcohol by volume. It is produced and bottled by Ed Phillips and Sons Company in Princeton, Minnesota. Thank you. Also, Pick and Shovelware. Head over to pickandshovelware.com. Check out all their awesome shirts and hats and hoodies. Again, it's getting a little cooler. I love a good hoodie, and they make awesome hoodies and apparel that are specific to Minnesota. They have all these fun graphic designs of your favorite sports teams, favorite sports moments as well. So very sports-centric, Minnesota sports-centric apparel company. You can get 20% off your first order at Pick and Shovelware if you just use the promo code LIEBER. That's LEBER, 20% off your first order. And also to Wexford Harbor Insurance. They're an independent insurance agent representing over 40 different companies. The guy that runs Wexford Harbor, Pat Kelly, look him up. He and his staff are sure to take care of you. They're going to find the best value for you, for your family, for your home, for all of your auto needs, anything that you're looking for, umbrella insurance, or if you're in the commercial space looking for commercial insurance as well. Over 40 different companies that he independently checks for you. That's Wexford-Harbor. That's harbour.com/unrestricted to find them. Wexford-harbour.com/unrestricted, or email them at info@wexford-harbour.com. All right, let's get back to the show. When did your parents and your family know that you had something special in you about becoming a professional racer? Was there an event or a aha moment where you felt like, yeah, they think I can do this too?
It would have been my last season. It was our last like amateur year in snowcross, and what it was, you know, it was a good lesson for me is. Going into that season, up to that point, my parents were my top sponsor, right? So it was costing quite a bit of money, and I remember they sat me down, you know, right before that season started, and they just said, "This is the last one, because we're pulling money out of a retirement, and it's costing us a lot of money to do this. So this is the last year we're going to be able to support you. After this, it's all on you." And I remember that thought process, and that's kind of where I think my, you know, going back to the positive outlook, I remember thinking at that point, I thought, you know what, if this is going to be the last year of racing, I'm going to make sure I have the most fun I can with it, right? Yeah. But there was two lessons I learned. I said, I'm going to work my butt off, and I'm going to, you know, at the end of the day, all I can do is do my best and have fun doing it. And that's what I did, and I remember I carried that mindset into the first race. It was in Duluth, Minnesota at Spirit Mountain. The Snowcross Series is was there, and I remember going there, and I just had like that positive outlook where I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna go out there and do the best I can, and you know, I'm gonna focus on everything just like I would. But at the end of the day, if it goes wrong, if you get upset with it, you're just wasting energy instead of using that energy of like, okay, how can I do this right, or right, how can I get it better? And I just went there with like a much better outlook, and we won both the semi-pro stock and semi-pro open. So we swept the semi-pro class, and like I remember the first race that I won. Up to that point, I had not won a semi-pro race, and I showed up and we won two of them. And I wasn't a factory rider. I was just me and Dad in the trailer.
Yeah,
sleds ran, but nothing spectacular. Yeah. And I remember too, even the Polaris team, other Polaris riders, the factory ones had this 800 motor, and I had like a 726, which was the B package, the smaller engine, right? So they would just murder me off the start, and so everyone takes off. I remember the final, the semi-pro final. Everyone takes off, and I'm way kind of buried in the pack, and I'm racing my way through. And I just remember I was like passing a lot of guys. And the track is shorter, so you get into lappers quick. So mm-hmm. I don't know if they're lappers. I don't know if I don't know where I am
on the
track.
Your goal is to pass the next guy in front of me.
Exactly. So yeah. I'm just passing people, and I'm like, gosh, seems like I've passed a lot of guys. So I was just excited because I wasn't tired because I had done my training and stuff beforehand. So I wasn't like exhausted or anything, and I'm like, awesome, I passed a bunch of guys. That's a success for me. So I threw a heel clicker off the finish line. And I remember the flag guy in the corner. He's just violently flailing his arms and clapping and, yeah, he's screaming and stuff. And I drove over to him, and he's like, dude, that was awesome. And I'm like, cool. Do you know what position I got? And he's like, you won, man. You won. And I'm like, really? I'm like, yeah. So I was so pumped. And so then that just kind of, It was like I learned right then and there. It was like, you know, have a positive outlook on things, work hard, be positive, and no matter what, just keep going. And that I've just kind of stuck to that because it's just continued to bring more success.
Well, it's worked out for you.
Right? Yeah, so yeah. I just stick to the plan, right?
Which is so fascinating because the way that you lay that out is if you're a young teenager and your parents kind of say, hey, we love to support your passion. This is what you're doing. But also, let's have some real talk.
Right.
And the real talk is we can't afford to keep doing this the way that we're going. And so this is it. Now, you took that opportunity and you ran it with a sense of positivity. I could see other people saying like, holy shit, that's a lot of weight on my shoulders.
Right.
You know,
right.
And maybe get bogged down by the stress of like, man, this sucks. Like, is this my last race ever? Like, could this be it? So I think it's a real testament to you that you took it the other way and said, let's just rip it. Let's just have fun. Let's just go wide open and let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. And then you win those two events. Now, do the earnings from those two events, does that get you in? Does that like satisfy the cost of the next ones down the road? Is that kind of
it keeps you going?
That's how it kind of like kept going. And then,
yeah.
And then when did Polaris come to you?
As soon as I did that, it was funny it was like, as soon as I won both those races and it was like, you know, because I worked my way up through the pack and passed them in the open one, they went, holy cow, we got to get you the bigger motor, you know, is the first thing, because I wasn't getting hole shots with the smaller motor. But they also, they put who's now the race director for Polaris, Tom Rager Jr., he actually started kind of being in our trailer all the time because my dad's like very mechanically inclined, but he's like not a tuner or anything.
Yeah.
So they're like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah. Right?
So they put him in there to kind of like make sure everything was happening because we kept winning. We won like seven of the eight races after that. And they were like, yeah, we're on board. But the thing that was interesting is like everything was going really well. And then I blew my knee out. Mm-hmm. I blew my knee out like with two races to go. And then it all of a sudden went from like, oh, wow, I might get a ride to, well, I might be done again.
Ooh.
You know, so it was like it was tough. And I remember when I tore up my knee, I also got compartment syndrome in my calf.
Oh,
so then I spent a week in the hospital down here with, you know, compartment syndrome, they essentially just cut the sides of your calves open.
Mm-hmm. And throw that pressure out.
Yeah, let that pressure out. So I was down there with that, and I'm in the hospital going, wow, like I was grateful that I had my leg, because they give you worst case scenario, like that they, mm-hmm. they, you know, if it goes too long, it kills the muscle and they have to amputate. So I was fortunate we beat that. And then, you know, shortly after that, players signed a contract with me saying that you're on board, 1 year deal for next year.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's awesome. And then from there, I just, you know, it was just more motivation to keep pushing.
Right. Because your strategy, it was working. You know, your approach was working. I do want to get into injuries. I mean, because I do love that aspect about sports, not to be morbid or anything.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think it's fascinating. The ACL that you talk about, how did that happen? Was it a wreck? Was it a fluke thing? You know, you see a lot of times, even in football, it's like, oh, it's a non-contact thing. I was just going to make this cut, and it just gave out of me. Like, yeah. How does it happen on a sled?
So on a snowmobile, a lot of times, like in snowcross, you're slamming into the bumps and whatnot. And because like on a dirt bike, your feet are kind of always under you. Mm-hmm. Like you can lean back and you can do things like that. But with a snowmobile, you can move your feet a lot further forward. So like when you're going to slam into something, you always like kind of put your feet in front of you just to brace yourself. Mm-hmm. So what happened was I like slid my feet forward and it hit a bump and I hyperextended my knee. So my knee went completely backwards, and then, you know, it tears your ACL and
yeah.
everything else. So that's how it typically happens. And I did it on both legs. I did it like 3 years later on my left leg, my ACL. And, you know, injuries, to speak to injuries, you know, again, looking back at it, it was injuries were like, they were the blessing in disguise for me anyway, because it would give me time to reflect on
yeah.
what's going on. And I would sit and go, okay, so why is this happening? And when I tore my knee up the second time, you know, it gave me that 6 months or whatever. And I came back from that and I addressed a bunch of the issues with my racing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I knew I needed to figure out how to get more speed in the corners. And the issue with finding more speed as a short person, I'm about the size of a sixth grader, right? So I'm a husky sixth grader, yeah. we'll say. So, you know, it's hard because the snowmobile relies a lot on leaning. So the taller you are, the further you can lean off, the more yeah. leverage you have, the more holding it down. So how can I do that when I'm 5.5 feet tall? And so I had to figure that out. And I just remember like thinking about it. And I would go out and, you know, once I could walk and stuff, I'm like sitting on the sled, like maybe it could be like this. And that next year, the first bit of snow, I was able to like develop this technique of how to corner. And there were two parts to it. One, I needed to figure out how to lean as far as I could. And mm-hmm. the other part was, how can I do it so you're not, like when you have your feet forward, it takes all your arm strength to kind of hold you forward.
Yeah.
So what I did is I'm like, how can I do that where I can stay forward, but I don't have to just sit there and use my arm strength the whole time to hold me there.
Right.
So I figured out that if I put my foot kind of behind me when I would go into the turn, it was a mechanical lock with your knee. So the only way to go
right.
backwards is if your knee dislocated, which knock on wood,
yeah.
it hasn't. So I learned that, hey, like that's what's holding me from sliding back. And because when you slide back, your arms are like the pendulum that swings you back to the center, mm-hmm. which means you're not leaning as far. So I learned this, like I like kind of developed this technique and learned it and was able to apply it, and it worked. And you know, that was one of the blessings that the injuries brought, and many of the other ones too. It just gives you that time, because I think that's one of the things that we don't do enough is go back and reflect on what has happened and what can we learn from that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the sad part about it for me was it would be injuries that would make me, you know, it was like I had to, I don't want to say I had to, but you just don't make it a priority to like stop and look back and learn. And the injuries always made me do that.
Right. But I'm sure your schedule didn't allow you a lot of time to really, really reflect. You know, especially when you're talking about how can I get more speed and power through the corner, you might have thought about that. And you're like, okay, I know that's an issue, but God, I got to go on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And you don't really have time to think about mechanically, how can I do this? So let's do this. Let's go through your list of injuries. What have you, so you had the two ACLs, you had the gnarly compartment syndrome, which is just – you know, I'm not going to go through it with all the listeners, but if you want to see something kind of gross and crazy that can happen with injuries, that's always a concern because that blood flow just does not get out of there. It's like stuck in that muscle or that joint, and they really do have to splay you open to get that pressure out of there. Well, what else have you had to deal with?
So I did both my knees, and then I separated both my shoulders, which they're the fun thing about the shoulders is they're still there. So like they just are hanging there, right? So it's like you can move it around and stuff like that. So,
what?
But that's what's awesome about it is like I did that a long, long time ago, and you know I remember being in line somewhere, and there was like a doctor was standing in line behind me, and I didn't know that, but he's like, hey, so you separated your shoulders, because like both of my shoulders are like that, so essentially my bones are like sticking up, and it makes like it almost makes like a coat hanger under the skin.
It does.
Is what it looks
I mean, that's
like
a good way to explain it. When you pulled your shirt sleeve down, your collar down, and showed me that just now, that's crazy. Like I've seen some AC joint sprains from football where it's kind of like the same joint. And you do have like mine's a little bit raised right here, but not like that's extreme, dude. That's really creepy to see.
It's creepy, but the funny thing is I remember like when it happened, the first one happened, the guy's like, so we can screw it down and plate it and stuff, but you know, with what you're doing, you're probably just gonna tear it off again. So if it doesn't bother you appearance-wise, it's not doing any harm. And I'm like, all right, well, we'll just leave it. So we just left it. Then I did it again like 3 years later. And so then I had matching ones. And I remember I was sitting in line, and this gentleman behind me is like, hey, so you separated your shoulders. I said, yeah, you know, one was dirt bike, one was snowmobile. And he's like, well, and he kind of looking at it. He's like, well, the positive is they're not touching anything. They're just sticking up in the air. So you shouldn't get arthritis in them. I'm like, well, that's one joint, I suppose.
Does it prohibit you from doing anything else?
No, like, no, it's been awesome. The only thing that I've ever noticed with them is when I sleep, if you sleep on your side at all, it pushes my like shoulder down, and then it like sticks into the mattress. That's the only thing. Which it's kind of like... that comes out kind of odd sounding, but it's really not that big of a deal.
Oh, you imagine like rolling over to your wife and she's like, oh, God, get your shoulder bone out of my back.
Yeah.
Like, you know, gross. No. Oh, so that's it.
So I did both my shoulders. Did both my shoulders, cracked my pelvis, fractured three vertebrae.
I thought I read something about your back.
Yeah, I broke my tibia. Broke my heel and my foot. My foot's all kind of lopsided. My heel was, it was sticking through my sock. And, like, there was a couple, like, pretty bad ones. And then dislocated my wrist. And then a bunch of flesh wound stuff. But there was, how it went is I was in this 4-year program. So it was like I would be healthy for 4 years, and then I'd be injured for 4 years, and then healthy for 4 years. And I did that for 16 years.
Wow.
That's what I did. So there was I tried to remember the one time frame. It was like how many years I was injured in a 5-year window. It was like 3/4 of the time I was broken, but I would get back in one piece just in time to start the next season. And, you know, so I was fortunate in that regard to be able to continue. But that's the thing that I really look back on, and I think about the, you know, because many people will go, boy, that sounds really stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds really dumb. But I think what it shows is like, yeah, maybe it was stupid, but at the same time, I think it shows how determined you can be when you have you have a goal of where you want to go.
Yeah, I think it's a great badge of honor. I mean, whether they're whether they're physical scars or there's emotional scars or whatever, they're all character builders, mm-hmm. and they all show people, if they care to know or care to learn to know, that setbacks are not going to deter me from my ultimate goal and what my determination is. So I that's why I think it's fascinating, because you know I do know some people that will suffer one injury, whether it be high school or college, mm-hmm. and they're like, that was it. That's when I just quit. And I'm like, wow, really? Like it took one injury, and then that set you off your course? Like, didn't you ever want to go back and just try it again? Like once you were healthy? And boy, you have a laundry list of reasons and examples of like, yeah, that's not going to hold me back at all. Now, when it comes to this sport, when you get injured, who pays for that? Is that Red Bull? Is that Polaris? Like, how does the health insurance part of this stuff equate into your sport?
No, it's all personal. So you have obviously, like, we have our own health insurance and life insurance is that one's a really fun one. I got a funny story for that too later. So it all comes on you. So obviously, my health insurance is pretty fair. It's pretty.
I mean, I couldn't imagine a. Thank God for no pre-existing issues going on right now with some healthcare providers. Yeah. But like, that was the nice thing about getting injured in our sport, where team takes care of it. I mean,
you
get injured on a Sunday or a practice, and you're getting, you know, multiple MRIs. I mean, they'll pay for second opinions. Like, they'll fly you. Like, I broke my foot in San Diego, and things just weren't getting better. And so we researched. Who's the best foot and ankle guy in the country? And it happened to be Dr. Anderson in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
Dude, they paid for my flight. They paid for my wife and I to go out there, hotel, the appointment.
That's awesome.
All that stuff. And I end up getting surgery by him, which they pay for. They don't do that with you guys.
No. So like most, like, so how we're all treated as subcontractor essentially. So we're all our own businesses. So you provide all of your own health care, all of your work comp, all that stuff is all within your own program, which is – it is a little bit different, but at the same time – I mean, in regards to, like, that's probably more so in our situation, because we went from going on a team. Like, we were on a team – I was on a team for, like, 3 years – six years I was on a team, and then I was like, okay, I'm ready to do this myself. So you go from like everything kind of being handled, but health insurance for sure, that was always kind of your own deal. But when we first started, I was on a team, everyone's kind of taking care of everything, and then I was like, hey, I want to start my own team. So I can make, you know, I can do whatever I want then. If I want the sled to be fluorescent pink, it'll be fluorescent pink, you know, because I just wanted to... I was always like wanted to be unique and different. Yeah. So I was like, that's going to be great, you know? And then so we do that, and it's like, holy cow, there's a lot of work.
Yeah, there's a reason why, you know, starting these things on your own are complicated, and people don't do them all the time.
When it really hit me was when I was the, in 2009, I was the pro stock champion is what I was. So I won the Snowcross Championship, which was, that was like the dream for me growing up racing, is to win the championship. So I win that championship, and then we start the team the next year, right? So I'm the defending champion. I show up at the first race to sign up. We always go in, you got to do check in and sign in. So I go to sign in to get my wristband and all that, and I'm like, you know, they're like, oh, hey, Levi, how are you doing? I'm like, yeah, good. And you know, they start looking at the list, and my name's not on the list. And they're like, your name's not on here. Did you register?
Oh, no.
And I went, no, I didn't, because prior to that,
it had been done for you.
Yeah, somebody did it for me. So I learned right away, like, you have to register for the race, and you have to.
Could you race that race then?
Oh yeah, they obviously let me in, but anyway, so that, it was like, it was really good. Like, starting the team when we did, it went from, you know, going just full athlete to, okay, now I'm athlete, and you know, I'm like, I have to like operate this team. So we had a couple riders then, and I'm dealing with all the sponsors, and I'm dealing with these different things. And I remember thinking about how much work it was, but I kept telling myself, like, this is good. You're going to learn a lot of good lessons from this that are going to help you in the future.
Yeah.
So I just kept pushing through that. And then at that same time, in 2009, when we won the championship, that was the same year that we rotated the double backflip on a snowmobile at X Games. And which, so like I was at the peak of both worlds then. And I'm like, holy cow. And then I'm like, I'm going to do the team. And so once I kind of did that double backflip, and it opened up my eyes, like the year prior, freestyle opened my eyes up to possibility, what I could do.
Right.
So the first thing is like, I think I can do a double backflip. And then once you start down that road, then everyone else is like, hey, I wonder what else you could do.
Right.
And they start giving you ideas. And then you're just like, you know, you give me an idea, I can take that to the moon. So yeah. I'm all over the place. So then it was like within 2 years of that, we're world record distance jumping. And, you know, and all, and through that time, 2009 is when I broke my heel. I had to have surgery the following year. So I spent a year and a half without being able to lift my heel off the ground.
Cool.
Because my foot was so messed up, and I would just tape the thing solid and keep riding. And then I had to have surgery the next summer. And then that following, following fall, then we started distance jumping, and that's when I had my distance jump crash, which was my big crash.
Yeah. So that distance jump was in San Diego.
Correct.
Right? Yeah, correct. So let's go through that now, because that's still a world record, and the idea of taking that machine that far is, even when you watch it, it's like, did I just really see that? Like, it's still sort of surreal when you, even when I watch it, I'm like, I can't believe, and I haven't been around a lot of snowmobiles, but I have, knowing enough that those are bigger machines. Like, that's a big machine to travel that far. How did you get to that point? You can even, you know, go through the injury and the crash and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then to get back out there and then do it, like, and it's still standing, because I think everybody else is like, this crazy motherfucker, nobody's going to attempt this thing, you know? Like,
I mean, it'll happen.
I'm sure it'll happen, but obviously nobody's attempting it lately, because I think they all realize that's a hell of a feat.
Yeah, it was a big jump, and, you know, that was kind of the thing is, like, you know, going in to kind of set the stage, the idea was originally Red Bull used to have a Red Bull New Year No Limits, and it was live on ESPN, and it'd be New Year's Eve night, and it'd be an hour-long show all dedicated to an athlete's feat, like this big project. You know, Robbie Madison did multiple ones on a motorcycle. Reese Millen, Travis Pastrana, they all did these things, and I was fortunate enough to go to some of them. And I was just like, that is awesome. Like, that is the biggest stage there is, right? So I'm like, that would be incredible to do that, because I, like, back then, it, like, the goal was always, like, to become, like, I kind of went up through X Games through the Shaun White era, which it was like, it was all Shaun White. And, like, you said the word snowboard, you said Shaun White.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the first thing. And I was like, that was kind of the goal. It's like, I want to be like, bigger than the sport. I want to be, you know, to get people to see it and stuff. So I'm like, that would be just amazing to be able to showcase, like, what we're capable of on Rebel New Year No Limits. And so I threw the idea out there, and I said, I've never distance jumped, but I think I can. You know,
so who had the previous record, and what was the previous record?
Paul Thacker had it. So Paul Thacker, friend of mine, he had that was kind of his world, was distance jumping. So he broke the record. I think he went maybe like 220 to 240 to 260, and then he was the first person to ever go over 300 feet on a snowmobile, jumped 301 feet. And I remember I got, you know, the poster, and he's got the tape measure out, the whole deal. And I'm like, that is insane. And, like, that whole time when he was doing that, I'd watch the videos, and I'm like, that is just ridiculous what he's doing.
Yeah.
And then after, like, back to, like, 2008, when I started doing freestyle and we had success, it really just opened up my eyes to go, you're capable of so much more. It's just, you just got to go out there and figure it out. And then we did the double backflip. And so then I was like, I can figure that out. So I told Red Bull, I said, I'd do a distance jump. I could totally do one. I'm like, I don't know how yet, but we'll figure it out.
Okay.
And that's how it kind of started. And we ended up going, you know, I went out to, well, the first thing that I get the call back and they said, hey, you still interested in doing a distance jump? I said, oh yeah, you bet I would. And they go, so the kicker is we'd like you to do it in San Diego. I started laughing. I said, well, last I checked, there's not a lot of snow in San Diego.
Yeah.
So that was the first hurdle, was trying to figure out how we could do it. And we were able to figure that out. And then from there, you know, we started testing. And I remember I'm like, well, so here's what we can do to make it safe. Well, you know, the landings are really long. They're like almost 200 foot long.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of area to land in. So I said, let's just put the ramp like 75 feet from the landing. So I just go bloop and just kind of skip my way over to it, just a little hop. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then we'll move it back from there. And I said, yeah, that'll be perfect. So I remember I get there on the first day of testing distance jump. And there's this 90-foot-long ramp, which it's the longest ramp I've ever seen in my life. And I'm like, wow, that is like, I mean, it's just long and flat.
Yeah.
You know? And I looked at that. I'm like, okay. But the problem was is they had a road that went diagonal between the ramp and the landing.
Okay.
So it was like 150-foot gap. It was like twice as long as what I was hoping, you know? So like your minimum jump at 150-foot gap is like you always want to give like a 25-foot safety deck buffer.
Yeah.
So my minimum jump, absolute minimum is 150. But the minimum that I wanted to go is 125 or 175. I'm sorry. So I'm like, that's not quite 75 feet, is it?
Yeah.
So it kind of instantly, like, you know, that was one of those back to the daredevil moments. That one was a daredevil one where you're like, just trust your instinct.
Trusted. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I remember taking off. So they had a radar gun and a radar board off to the left of the ramp. And here we are in San Diego. The sun is at my back, so it's shining right on the radar board. It's all glossed over. So I take off, and the snowmobile, you know, there's like a point of no return at the on the runway where, like, you go past that, you got to hit
the
jump.
Yeah, you got to commit,
So they go, okay, like, prior to that, you know, the ramp that we use is very similar to what Travis Pastrana used to jump his rally car. And he's like, you know, Travis jumped about 187 or whatever, and he was going 62 or whatever. So, like, I'd just say don't go any slower than 60.
So wait a minute. They make it seem like they're just sort of throwing numbers out there. Like, there wasn't, like, more of a scientific.
Nope.
Oh, my God. What?
I think they did more of it maybe with Travis. But, like, here's, like, the thing is – like, jump in, once you, like, a lot of people ask me that, like, so do you have, like, you guys have it all laid out, like, this equates to this, and you can go down that road and you can try that stuff. The problem is there's so many variables, you know, like the snowmobile, for instance, how much wind does it, you know, catch to slow you down, all these different things. So the easiest way to go about it is jump small, and with a long landing, you jump small, and you jump bigger, and you jump bigger, and you keep all your data. Here's my speed. Here's my distance. Here's the wind speed. And then you can kind of figure out, like, a ballpark what you'll do from that point forward. But that first jump was twice as big as I had hoped to, like, my first distance jump.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so you got to just do this. So, you know, you give yourself the little pep talk, and they said, you know, you want to go about 60. That's what Travis did. So I, like, say, okay. So I come in. I've never jumped with a radar board before. It's just always just like, this feels right. I'm going to hit it.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I take off down the runway, and I'm like just staring at that board, and I got to keep looking back to center to make sure I'm going straight. So I'm going to hit the center of the ramp. So I'm looking at the thing. I'm looking at the center, and I'm looking. I'm getting closer. I'm getting a little faster. I still don't see any numbers on the board, and I'm going back and forth. And I finally get to almost the bottom of the ramp. I don't see any numbers on the board, and I'm obviously at the point of no return. I look up at the ramp, and I just held it wide open. And I landed perfect where I was supposed to, like the perfect sweet spot. I landed, and I remember the first guy from Red Bull, he came up. And the guy's awesome, Dave. He's like, man, that was perfect. What speed did you have on the radar board? And I said, man, I don't know. I didn't see one. I didn't see any numbers. And he's like, what? And I'm like, I don't know if it was the sun at my back. I don't know. I didn't see a number. So they go over and they check the radar gun, and it never was turned on. No one turned it.
Oh, no.
No one turned the radar gun.
So it wasn't the sun at all.
No. So we all started laughing. And
yeah, because you survived.
Exactly. So I make it through that. So then they turn the radar gun on the next time. So I go, okay, I got to make sure I get up to 60 mile an hour. So I hammer down. I'm like, I have like a huge run in. So I hammer down and I see 60 and it goes right past to 70. And I go, oh man, I'm going to overshoot the jump. So I let off. And as I'm getting closer, then I see it dip down into the 50s. And I go, oh man, yeah. I hold it wide open again right at the bottom. And I came off the ramp, and the landing was probably like 5 feet taller than the ramp. Maybe even taller. And I came off the ramp, and all I saw was the back of the landing.
No.
And I went, oh my goodness, I am going to just lawn dart myself right into the back of that landing at 60 mile an hour, right? It's going to be not good. And I just kept going, and then the sled just kept rising. And I literally landed, like, I have a picture where I'm like 1 foot, the back of the track is from the back of the landing. And it was almost vertical wall. So I would have exploded.
You died.
And I just went, wow. Like, I don't think I like that radar board either. So then we just went to, because the snowmobile is really consistent speed-wise. So, like, you know, 400 feet, I can get it within 3-4 mile an hour every time. So I would do a whole shot, like a really hard start, a medium start, and then like a real slow start, and just see what speeds we would get. And that's how we kind of determined
because you don't have a speedometer on your and they're not, none of them are like that, right?
No, the snowmobiles have them, like your normal trail sleds and stuff, but the race sleds don't have any of that.
Is it
and,
attack?
You just yeah, you just have you attack, and you don't look at that, like you're just looking ahead.
It's just feel.
Yeah, so it was. So that fortunately went well, and then after that, you know, essentially what it did was, instead of having to look at the radar board, instead of having to like think, I just said, let's figure out how I can just hole shot and just hold it wide open. Because if I can do that, and then that'll, you know, we know it's going to be this mile per hour because the sled's so consistent. You just give me the distance. You know, if we need to jump 300 feet, I'm going to need 750 feet of running. You know, because I need to go 100 mile an hour. And the sled will do that consistent enough. So, like, what it turned into, because the issue with the snowmobile is you really have to make sure it's straight, like perfectly straight, because there's a piece of AstroTurf up the center of the ramp that's roughly a foot wide, and that's traction for the track to go up.
Yeah.
And if you miss that, it's plywood, which would spin, and then it would cause, you know, most like a big nose-down crash. So I really had to make sure at 100 mile an hour, I'm within 6 inches left to right of that. So we had a dotted line where I would look at the dotted line. I'd look up the ramp, dotted line, and I'd just keep going back and forth until I went off the ramp. And so like as far as like looking off to the side at the radar board, that was kind of throwing me off. So I said, let's just dumb this up.
Yeah.
Just give me where I got to start from, and I'll just hold it wide open and go off there. And that ended up being the easiest way to do it. And because the landing was so long, you could be in a 50-foot area.
Right.
So the couple mile an hour didn't matter.
Yeah, you had a margin of error. A little bit. Yeah. So the final jump was how far? Just
the final one was 412 feet.
Okay. So 412 feet. What are you thinking? Is there a thought going through your head as you hit a jump and you're hurtling through the air? Or does it really happen so fast that it's like you just, and you're so focused that you're just looking at the landing, just trying to assess things, and you're still doing, you know, instantaneous calculations even as you're in the air? Do you get a sense of like, is there a holy shit moment in the middle of the air, or are you just like focused?
I would say you're focused the whole time. I would say that the scary moments hopefully don't happen, but when they do, you kind of know just from history of like all the jumps you've done, all the things, you kind of know like, this could go wrong or it could go right, and you most times in those situations, throttle helps you out of it because it's usually it's because you're getting crooked or something like that. And to straighten it out, if you land and the track is going 10 mile an hour faster than you're traveling, it's going to want to pull you straight. Yeah. So you wide open throttle out of it, which is it's really hard to do, like especially you know in motocross if you're going through a whoop section and the thing starts kicking back and forth the back end. How you solve that is hold it on faster, right? Which it's like,
which is counterintuitive.
It is because all you want to do is be like, I gotta stop. I need to stop this right now, and you can't because if you stop, it actually works like the brake. So what it does is it loads the back end even more and catapults it even harder. Then, so your best bet is just to throttle on more, and that's like probably one of the hardest things to learn in jumping and motocross and such.
Yeah. So then what was that elation like when you hit that landing at 412 feet?
412 feet. It was so cool. It was so cool because, you know, we had to jump over a 300-foot water gap, you know, to get there. And so I was on the other side. I was on the other side of this harbor. And I'm over there, and my wife, Kristen, she was there for the first bit. And then she, you know, she came up and, you know, kissed me. I don't want to say goodbye, but yeah. I'll see you on the other side, right? And then she got on a boat. She went over to the other side, and I'm over there, and, you know, the fog rolls in, and for a moment, we couldn't even see the ramps, and I'm going, oh, my goodness, this is, like, as stressful as it can get, right? And you're just sitting there, and it's like, I can't imagine, I don't know how to, what to compare it to, but it's like it's the most fearful you can be, but knowing you have to. Like, I don't know if there's anything to relate that to, but it's like I was as nervous as you could be, I was as scared as you could be, but at the same time you put that in the back seat and you go, focus on the task at hand. What do we have to do? Center line, go down the middle, wide open throttle. And I had practiced and rehearsed all this for weeks. Like, yeah. We weren't able to do any practice for three weeks, but I had wrote down all of the keys that I had to remember that I had learned in our testing, and I rehearsed it every day for 3 weeks just in my head. I would just sit there for, you know, a while and just rehearse it and then do that. So I just was going through that procedure, and then when it was game time, it's like, okay, here it is. They say, okay, fire it up, and we start warming up the engine, and I'm like, I'm pumping myself up, I'm getting going, and you know, you're just like, you got this, right? You're just telling yourself, you got this, man, you've done it, you got it, you know, and you're psyching yourself up, and then they say, okay, line it up, and they would let Matto, who Robbie Madison was the gentleman on the dirt bike that was jumping with me, side-by-side jumps. So they would let Matto go first. He came from 500 feet behind me. I'm sitting there on my sled like I'm doing a snowcross racing hole shot. I'm just ready to be like, oh, just turn me loose like that. And then you hear him coming. He goes flying by me. And then they wave their hand, go. And I'm like, when? I'm like wide open. And I'm like, stay in the center. And I'm watching the lines go by. And I come to the ramp. And I'm like, I look up because they're like, once you get to the ramp, you got to look up and off of it. And I look up and I hit the ramp like square, and I went to my left foot. And when I hit the ramp, I kind of like compressed onto my left leg. So my body position fell off to the left. The sled starts veering right. And there's like a GoPro on the nose of my sled that I went back and looked at. And like, if you stop it at the right frame, I'm going to land next to the landing. Oh. Missed the landing completely because I remember, I'm like, oh, man. So I quick did this little like kind of like adjustment, like kind of like whipping it back. But the craziest thing was it wasn't like any other time I've ever like whipped a snowmobile or dirt bike. You could feel the air like it was carving you.
Yeah.
Over there.
Like you're flying.
Yeah, it was such a weird feeling because the snowmobile is so flat on the bottom with the running boards and the thing. It literally was like carving me back over there. And I'm like, holy cow. So I like carve over there, and then it was just perfectly straight. And it flew so perfect all the rest of that jump. And I remember just being up there, and I'm like,
Well, yeah, you couldn't even breathe.
No,
take a breath.
You don't. You know, everyone's like, "Oh, did you look over at Robbie?" And I'm like,
"No,
I was just looking at the landing. That's all I wanted to get to." And I remember they had 400 feet marked off in a different color. It was like white marks.
Yeah.
And 400 feet was blue. And I remember I'm like, I'm coming in down that landing, and I'm like watching the lines. They're shooting by, and I'm like, "There's the blue one." And I'm like, "Oh." Oh, the blue ones went by. I went past the blue one. And then I land, and you could kind of hold the back end of the sled up a little bit longer.
Yeah.
To get more distance.
Yeah.
But it
to, like a long jumper.
You would do that, but that would turn into a much harder landing.
Yeah.
But
you're I'm like, more flat, right?
I'm like, but this is the big show, man. You got to do it. So I hung on to it as long as I could, and I landed I like headbutt the handlebars, and I like collapse into the dash, and I pop right up, and I'm like, yes. I like put my arm up, and I hit the wet grass, and the sled is like sliding sideways. I'm like, definitely not going to stop before that wall, right? So I just go, I'm like sliding, and I remember I'm like, okay, so I'll just take in like, I'll throw the sled and like run out of it, right? That's what I'm thinking. So I go for the throw, like trying to be cool, you know? I throw the sled, I hit the wet grass, I go, whoop, I go right to my butt. So there I am, I'm like in a bobsled losing position, feet forward, sliding in the grass, and the sled piles into they had a cement barrier wall, like NASCAR one, and then they put some tough blocks in front of it, and I sled runs into that, and I just slid in right between the ski and the tracks, slid in, and I climb out from under there, and then I was like losing it, because you're like, oh my goodness,
well,
this is incredible.
I mean so much planning and so much anxiety, and it's like all that in that moment, it's over. I can't imagine the elation that you had, but that's the other part of it. You, as you lay that out there, it's the approach, it's the small adjustment in the air, but then even when you land, you're still going that fast.
Yeah.
So it's still pretty dangerous even after you hit the ground, because your body's still traveling at that rate of speed. So like,
right,
if you fall off weird or you start cartwheeling on the ground, that's broken bones right there.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Because, I mean, you think about it too, like when we hit the ramp for that jump, they were radaring me from behind, and I was going, it was the fastest speed we had in any of our testing, any of our jumps, and we were going 111 mile an hour. So, I mean, it's like, it's one thing to go like, you know, you get on a snowmobile and you go 100 mile an hour, you're like, I'm cruising, right? But it's a whole different animal when you're looking at a ramp at the end of it.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, I was so excited and just grateful for all the work that everyone did to make it possible.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell people, it's like I said, it's harder to make a setup and build a sled that can withstand, you know, the forces of a 400-foot jump and get up to 111 mile an hour. I said, I was the easy part, finding a knucklehead to hold it wide open.
So what is next for you? Like, you know, probably not going to be going out to break that record.
No.
But you obviously still have a competitive spirit. You obviously still enjoy doing what you're doing. And it sounds like you enjoy challenging yourself more than anything else. Like, so what's the next big challenge for you?
That's a really good question, because that's what's fun about it, is now it's trying to figure out, like, because you obviously can't do double backflips and distance jumps forever. So, you know, the goal is always to stay involved in snowmobiling. That's the passion that I've had forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's really fun, is now it's like trying to figure out what are the things that can be challenging within, you know, the parameters of what is capable for you at this point. And, you know, we're still not quite done with the wild stuff, but it's definitely getting closer to that. You know, we're doing a lot more focus with trail sled and crossover sleds, like kind of like the stuff that I started when I first started riding, which is really refreshing, because I haven't been in that realm since I was, you know, 12, 13 years old. So going back to that, it just really makes me appreciate riding my snowmobile that much more, because so many years have been, you know, train, practice, figure this out, do these things. And now it's like, just go ride because you enjoy it.
Yeah.
And
just
I
go
love
for the,
that.
For the fulfillment and the enjoyment of just being on the sled. I think your sport's fascinating to me because it's so dependent on the weather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could have all the aspirations and excitement to go out, and it's wintertime, and like technically we're right now, we're in wintertime in Minnesota, but yet you could have all this like built up, like, yes, it's wintertime.
Right.
But yet the snow might not come. And then the snow might come, but it might be a half an inch of snow. And you're like, right. Oh, shoot. Like, that's, not, you know, I can't really still do anything with that. But, like, that's got to be sort of frustrating, right? To, like, just always rely on Mother Nature.
It is. It's very frustrating as a snowmobiler. But I think it almost makes you more of an optimist, because you're just always that guy that's like, it's going to come. Stay positive. It's going to come. And then you're like, it's going to come next week.
Yeah.
You know, you're just always like thinking that way. And so that's, you know, and it's really fun this time of the year. Like, you start, say, September, like on social media, that's like once September hits, the snowmobilers like come out.
Yeah.
And they're like, dude, is it snowing yet? Do you get your new sled? Did you, you know, they're just excited. And there's something weird about snowmobiling, not weird, but it's just like really, it's really fun. Interesting to me how passionate people are about snowmobiling. Like, because I ride motorcycle and I boat and I do all these other things that I really enjoy. But the snowmobilers are just this diehard breed that are like, eat, sleep, and breathe it, and they absolutely love it. And that's what, you know, and I'm one of them, right?
Yeah.
So like, it's fun because you start talking to these people about snowmobiles in the fall, and they are just like, ready to rock. They're like, when is it, you know, like I got one of my new sleds a few weeks ago, and I like we got snow like that week then, so I was out ripping wheelies in the field, and people are just like, oh my goodness, when I didn't get my sled yet, when's mine coming in? And I'm like, oh it's coming. So it's really a cool community, the snowmobile community is, and everyone's like, you know, they just out there having fun. It's cool because, you know, people do it for fun. It's something that they enjoy. So it's like fun to be able to be in a position where it's like, you know, considered my job, snowmobiling.
Yeah.
But, you know, to think that's one of the things that always keeps me grounded about it is like people do what you're doing for fun.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So don't ever complain about having to do this.
Right.
I mean, because, you know, and I learned that early on in racing, because like I remember one of the things with racing, we would do autograph sessions, and I remember the one teammate I had early on, and he's like, oh, we gotta go do an autograph session.
Yeah.
And you know, and I thought just a year prior to that was like probably the first time I signed an autograph, and I went, you know, and I was losing it. I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah, people care about what
they want to get a picture with me. So I remember him saying that, and I just like, I remember like I stopped and thought about it, and I said, I'll sign any autograph anywhere, ever. Like, and I'll sign it till every last person gets one, because I'm like, that's like the biggest high five you can get. If somebody wants an autograph, they want a picture with you.
Yeah.
Like when I lived at home early on, I did dirt work like in the last years in high school and stuff, and I remember like we would put sidewalks in, or we would put roads in, and we put people's sewers in and stuff, right?
Yeah.
In which you dig it in and you put lay the pipe, you do all that stuff. And I thought we did really good job. And there wasn't one time where anyone said afterwards, like, hey, you mind if we get a picture together?
Right,
you know? So like when I got to like where people were like, hey, can I get a poster? Can I get an autograph? Can I get a picture? I'm like, that's incredible.
I'm just out here riding snowmobiles, like having fun. You want my picture?
Yeah. So I've always kept that, because it's just I think that's just incredible. And now you look at the people that are following you and stuff, and you know, we're just like posting about the stuff we like, and like obviously I'm big into quotes and stuff like that, and it's been amazing. Like we do like a Motivation Monday, right? And we just post a quote and some of the stuff that, you know, touched me or whatever. And I've had like people like contact us like, hey, you know, that's really helped me through a tough time, like, you know, my wife passed away, it's really helped me, that positive energy. And I just like, then it really starts making you think about the impact you can have on people, and what you can do to help. And that's, you know, that's kind of where we're at, you know, at this stage, is like, it goes from everything being about you and your career and you're doing this stuff to, how can I help people?
Yeah.
What can I do to contribute?
So since we're talking about that, Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you? I'm sure everybody that's going to listen to this already follows you on Instagram and social media, but this is your chance to kind of like put that out there.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can go right to our website, levilavalley.com, which are, my name is often butchered. So it's it's Lavallee, LAVALLEE. And then we, you know, social media, Levi_Lavallee for Facebook and Instagram. And then we also have Live in Lavallee on YouTube, which is, you know, it's just me doing our thing on snowmobiles and everything like that. So it definitely easy to reach out. And we're very, you know, I always, even on social media, I try my best to try to keep up with it because, you know, if you can, there's a lot of people have questions. A lot of people are trying to want to learn stuff. And it's like, if I can help contribute to that, that's great. It's harder though, because, you know, you get a lot of comments. So I apologize if I don't get to everyone right
away. I think
away.
People understand, especially when you have the following that you do. I mean, let's be honest. You get 100 people or 50 people that, you know, off of one post that just have a comment or a question, you want to sort of honor that. That's a lot of time for you to sit down and like break off from what you're doing. You got a family of 2 kids and a wife, and you still are a normal person, and it's like, you know, you pull yourself away and you're on your phone or computer and you're just kind of doing this stuff. And yes, it's kind of work, you know, but it can be a lot, you know, and now you're just answering comments or questions. And that might be one social platform.
Right.
Might just be one off of YouTube. And then all of a sudden you open your Instagram. It's like, oh my God, I got another 100 to get to. Like, so I think people understand that. And I think that, even just following you, I think people understand that you're doing your best. Like, you're doing your best to have, you know, motivational stuff and just having fun. Because that's the other thing, is like, you're not just about snowmobiles. Like, you're doing stuff on your wakeboard and you know, on your boats, and you're enjoying the Minnesota summers as well, as much as you're finding the passion for that as you are the Minnesota winters. And I think that's the fun thing, is like, you're always finding kind of unique and fun ways to have fun. And it seems like your family's having fun, like in lockstep with you the whole way, you know? And I'm going to guess that your kids will probably go down that path of saying like, hey, Dad, when do I get to start jumping?
Oh, yeah.
When do I get to start doing some fun stuff like that?
The conversation I had, I think it was last week with my son, was, I want to jump my 120 as a little snowmobile. And then, you know, me, I'm always thinking like, well, how could you do it better, right? So then I was like, all right, so buddy, if you get it figured out, what I'll do is Dad will lay down on the other side of the jump and you can jump over me.
Oh, no way.
And he goes, I want to jump over you lengthways from head to toe. And I'm like, well, we'll build up to that.
Yeah, we'll build up to that. Yeah. Well, this has been outstanding. And again, I can't thank you enough for taking the car time, the time away from your family to drive down just to sit with me and tell your story and share. Again, your amazing positivity and energy with all of this and with everybody else. So, again, really appreciate it. And that'll do it, man. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you for having me, man.
And this is the part where I tell everybody to subscribe to the podcast, unrestricted, like it, dislike it. I don't really care as far as give me a bad feedback, but feedback is always good. So I do read all the feedback, and that's the thing. You and I both know that feedback is important. So far, so good. There's been a lot of positive feedback. So I do want to thank Douglas and Todd Bourbon, locally crafted here in Minnesota, gold medal winning bourbon. It's made right here. So go find yourself some Douglas and Todd. We've also got Wexford Harbor Insurance. My good buddy Pat Kelly there will handle all your insurance needs, which that, by the way, that little box for you is some glasses. I'm not sure if you're a drinker or not, but some little lowball glasses for him. And in Pick and Shovelware at pickandshovelware.com, use unrestricted as the promo code for your discount there. And that's it. So thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.